This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, the end of a very busy week, so let's get right to it with our Week in Review. Starting with Newton's Mount Ida College, which struck a deal to close its doors and sell its campus to UMass Amherst, a terrible surprise to some of the school's students, such as freshman Amanda Mogras, who spoke with WCVB.
It was pretty shocking. It was kind of last second. It wasn't exactly very fair. They told us when we had no other option but to go to the one school that they provided. And what if I don't want to go to that big school? And it doesn't have my major. I'm dental hygiene.
Well, Mount Ida students have been offered admission to UMass Dartmouth, but the fact that UMass Amherst is spending $75 million in the deal is angering some at UMass Boston. Here's Katie Matrano, UMass Boston Undergraduate Student Council President on NBC Boston.
This purchase sends the message that UMass Boston does not matter. And I think that there is a racial proponent to it.
Well, UMass Boston is the only majority-minority school in the UMass system, and it's cutting programs and staff amid budget woes. But Marty Meehan, president of the entire UMass system, defended the decision, saying Amherst got a bargain on a ready-built campus near Boston, which will bring Amherst students closer to the city's jobs.
Giving students the experience they need to get jobs when they graduate in STEM fields, in companies in Greater Boston, I would say that is not frivolous. It's something fundamentally core to the UMass mission.
So there's a lot to talk about here, and let's do so with Ed Lyons this week. He's a Massachusetts Republican activist and political writer. Ed, it's good to see you again.
It's good to be back.
Also with us is John Carroll, professor of journalism at Boston University and WBUR senior news analyst. John, great to have you as well.
Great to be here.
Okay, I should note, though, that the state's Board of Higher Ed still needs to approve the terms, right, that Mount Ida's closure and UMass Amherst's planned expansion involves. And Mount Ida has some $55 to $70 million of debt, and as a part of that sale, some 300 faculty and staff will be laid off, because we heard mostly from students there in the past minute. But John, let's start with you. Your take on this.
This is going to be a case study at Harvard Business School on how yeah. not to handle a situation like this. Marty Meehan said to the Boston Globe today, he said, "Optics only matter in politics, not running a real university." He's totally miscalculated on that front. I mean, to go out and blindside the Board of Higher Ed, they find out through media reports that this is happening. I think they've just mishandled it. And so it's really hard to judge it on its own merits, because there's so much baggage attached to it now that it's that the debate is really over how it's being handled and been handled, not really over the merits of it.
Yeah, so many bad optics, if we could say.
Exactly.
Ed, what's your view here?
Well, I think it was a good decision. I don't think it has anything to do with UMass Boston. They're going to borrow money to buy the campus, and you can't borrow money to pay operating expenses at UMass Boston. That's not a good business decision. I think it shows that, you know, that this school is in trouble. They didn't have any good options. I think there are a lot of small private colleges in America with very shaky finances. Most of the endowment money is owned by the top 40 schools. I think 2/3 of all endowment money is owned by 40 schools.
Mm-hmm.
I think as the number of high school graduates goes down, and as the value of degrees in small schools keeps dropping, you're going to see a lot more schools suddenly running out of money, even in this area.
Okay, so you're actually making a good point that I was going to get to later, but since you bring it up, John, I wonder what you think about this, because Mount Ida isn't the only small New England college recently to have to close its doors. I mean, BU bought Wheelock College, for example.
Right. I think there's going to be a shakeout, and a lot of the smaller colleges are either going to go online or they're going to go out of business. I think the big colleges will stick with the bricks and mortar system, and there will be a demand for residential university education. But I think that a lot of the schools in the middle are going to really be squeezed, and I think that they're going to have more and more trouble. Mm-hmm. Online education is eventually going to happen on a much bigger scale than it is now. I mean, they're finding out how to do it effectively. It's completely cost effective, and it's more respectable now, I think, than it was previously.
Right. So let's get back to the tension between UMass Amherst, or at least the tension that seems to be emerging between UMass Amherst and students and faculty at UMass Boston. I want to play a little bit more tape here. Here's Marty Meehan, again, president of all five of the schools in the UMass system. He spoke to WBUR this week, and he said that no matter what people believe, the money from Amherst, from UMass Amherst, shouldn't actually go towards supporting UMass Boston.
The notion that students who attend UMass Amherst should have the money that they pay in tuition go to the Boston campus where they don't attend, that doesn't make any sense at all.
And here's the opposite view from UMass Boston English professor Joe Ramsey. He was on with NBC Boston.
There is money in the UMass system to expand UMass Amherst into Boston, but apparently not money to support the existing campus that we have. Amherst can have two campuses, but we can't even have one.
Now, Ed, a little earlier you said you didn't necessarily see the problem here, the same tension, but upon hearing those two pieces of tape, what do you think?
Well, I guess optics matters, doesn't it?
It does. Clearly it does.
No, I mean, education is a really important industry to Greater Boston. I think you're always going to see politics around decisions, and especially in this time where, as John said, we're going to have a shakeout, you're going to see a lot of different opinions on how this should be managed once the bubble starts to really pop. So, of course, there's going to be anger. UMass Boston has always felt like it's never had enough money, never had the right leadership, all kinds of problems. So anything that the system does that doesn't help them, they're going to be angry at. But I still think that UMass Amherst needs to keep getting stronger to make the system stronger.
John, is there a not seeing the forest for the trees problem here? Because Marty Meehan also noted that if the planned sale of the Bayside lot in Boston does go through, that could bring as much as, I don't know, something like $180 million for UMass Boston.
Right, if it does go through.
And
I think that there may be merits to this move, but I think that the way to handle it so that they didn't leave so many people in the lurch was to let Mount Ida operate for another year. Don't accept a freshman class, because they accepted a freshman class that has very limited options now. They have to scramble to go someplace else. And don't necessarily set up a situation where the students have to go 60 miles to another school that may not even have the courses that they had started out taking and the major that they had started out taking. So I think that if they had just put in some bumper time, I think it would have cured a lot of the problems here. And then, again, people could judge it on the merits as opposed to on the emotions.
All right. Well, let's move on to something that's also kind of plagued by bad optics, Facebook, plus also just probably bad decision-making. But this week, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg did testify before the House and Senate committees in Washington over the company's role in the Cambridge Analytica data scandal. He took questions from, again, both senators and members of the House on how Facebook handled user data. And for the breach of trust that he says happened to some 87 million users, Zuckerberg apologized.
"We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a big mistake. And it was my mistake, and I'm sorry. I started Facebook, I run it, and I'm responsible for what happens here."
Okay, but Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts pushed Zuckerberg on new legislation, asking him if he'd support a bill that, for example, would require affirmative permission from tech companies to share user data.
"Senator, I, in general, I think that principle is exactly right, and I think we should have a discussion around how to best codify that."
"Would you support legislation to back that general principle?"
"Senator, as a principle, yes, I would."
But he also said he wouldn't specifically support any current legislation and that the details matter. So, Ed, let me just start with you. I mean, do you think Facebook is headed down the road of being more tightly regulated after what we heard this week?
Yes. First, I'd like to remind our listeners that Facebook is a local company. There are several hundred people who work in Cambridge. They're wonderful people who are great citizens of Boston. Some of the infrastructure involved was actually built right here in Boston, and they have a growing presence.
Let alone the very first use of Facebook as a hot or not website on Harvard's campus, but
in Mark Zuckerberg's dorm room, let's not forget.
Exactly. But go ahead, Ed.
So, I mean, I think it's very hard to figure out what to do about Facebook, because Facebook is so big. I mean, it has more than 2 billion monthly users. It has more than 1.5 billion log on every day. It's involved in so many parts of our lives. It's not like a big company that's time to regulate. It's more like a layer of our society, this big kind of digital aristocracy where thousands of people are writing computer code to direct the affairs of billions of people.
Yeah.
And I think that it's not that Facebook is big enough to regulate. It was big enough to regulate several years ago. But we're starting to see all these negative things happening because they've created this enormous ecosystem that's very hard to control. I mean, they care about privacy. If you try to find out how your ex is doing on Facebook and you're not friends with her, you're not going to find out that they locked down a lot of things very, very well. But what they've lost control of is the millions and millions of third-party applications that get approved by users to share data. And that hasn't gone well because it's an enormously complex problem. and it isn't clear to me what regulation would handle that because the users are clicking the OK buttons to do all of this. So I think
They don't even know what they're agreeing to half the time.
That's right,
because
this is a persistent problem on the internet where people have these long user agreements or complicated prompts, and there's no easy way to say how do I sort of give permission in a way that someone's actually going to read. So that's why probably why Zuckerberg's not interested in debating legislation in front of a committee, because he doesn't know what it would look like.
Well, and so John, I'm wondering what you think about this. The other thing is that for the past 15 plus years, Facebook has done an excellent job of saying I'm sorry multiple times to different things, and then they might tweak something here or there, and then the next thing blows up in their face and they say I'm sorry. I mean, ostensibly that could go on forever.
It could, and it has gone on forever. And one of the problems was that Mark Zuckerberg was like an answer bot during the testimony, and he was so programmed it was like a rope-a-dope. He just wanted to get through the 10 hours. And one of the things that did not come up is there is already a consent decree with the Federal Trade Commission that they would not do exactly what happened with Cambridge Analytica, and there is a fine, $40,000 fine for every violation every day. So multiply that by 87 million, and you've got a lot of money there. I don't think that Congress knows enough about Facebook and how it works, which they proved pretty conclusively over those 2 days, to regulate it, frankly. Orrin Hatch is asking him, well, how do you run a service where you don't charge people?
I've heard that before. But on the other hand, I mean, no single congressperson or senator is going to know a lot about any industry that government regulates. But that's why you have, ideally, career people in government with expertise in these fields. I mean, are we saying that there's nobody in government that could assist members of the House and Senate?
Well, they certainly didn't assist them in the run-up to these 2 days of testimony. If I were a senator going out there trying to make an impression in 5 minutes, I would take a crash course and seem to know what I was talking about.
Yeah. Ed, I mean, let me just play another piece of tape here before I turn back to you, because this is Ethan Zuckerman. WBUR spoke with him this week. He's the director of the Center for Civic Media at MIT. And he gets to something that you were getting to a little bit earlier, but he's taking a look specifically at Facebook's business model entirely.
We're at the point where people see this as a specific data breach with Cambridge Analytica. I really see this as a symptom of a much larger problem. And that much larger problem is the fact that we've built this whole economy on not charging people for the goods and services they use, but instead advertising to them as a way of making the revenue.
So that's a slightly different view. But you were saying earlier, Ed, about how Facebook is really integrated into how our society operates. So, is there an economic solution here? I mean, in asking them to change their business model somehow?
I mean, you don't have to use Facebook, right? I mean, it's weird. Like, this is like something out of Atlas Shrugged. Like, they give us this free product that changes the world and helps everybody, and now we're angry at them because we pressed the buttons and shared our information with the wrong people. Like, I do think that they should be regulated. I do think that it should be more like HIPAA, where they have a responsibility to protect their information and have consent in some way. But I think that they said, well, you don't have to pay for it. You can just have all this benefit for free. And I'm amazed at the benefit in my own life that I've gotten out of using Facebook and all the things it allows me to do that I've never been able to do before. So I don't think that this is a problem. Nobody forced me to use Facebook.
One of the problems to me is that Mark Zuckerberg was not honest about what Facebook does. He sat there and said everybody has complete control over their data, which may be true of the data that they put on Facebook, but it's not true of the data that Facebook collects from third-party apps, from other websites. They have a hidden tracker network
that is basically
attached to 25% of the top 1 million websites. And so they are tracking you everywhere you go. They've got your location. They've got what you're doing on other sites, even when you're not on Facebook. And I think that's the part that didn't come out. So that's the part that people don't control. And that's the part that really that Mark Zuckerberg is most interested in, because that's how he carves people up and sells them to marketers.
Well, before we move on to another topic here, I actually want to take a minute here to provide a clarification on something regarding Facebook that happened on this show yesterday, because most of the time we try to do as much real-time fact-checking or providing context as we can. We're talking about complicated issues like Facebook. And I have to say, I dropped the ball yesterday at a particular moment in our conversation with Hiawatha Bray of The Globe. We were talking about Facebook and privacy and other political campaigns in previous election cycles that have used Facebook data. And that's the fact, that's because Facebook was essentially allowing any developer to access a lot of data until at least 2015. And then Hiawatha said this.
Not if you believe that woman, I forget her name, who was quoted for the Obama from America campaign, who basically said that they were allowed to basically read everything. They were given access to the entire social graph of Americans on Facebook back during 2012. It was at least as big, probably bigger than what happened. So no, actually, this was not bigger than what had happened before.
Okay, and usually I would have the facts at, like right at the top of mind, and I'd be able to provide some context, and I didn't do that yesterday. So listeners, just give me a minute here to clarify what Hiawatha was talking about. First of all, the woman he was talking about is someone named Carol Davidson. She was the Obama campaign's director of media analytics. And in 2015, she did say they were able to download the entire social network of the United States, and Facebook back in 2011 had the ability for people to opt in. And in her words, the Obama campaign rocked this. We got people to opt in. So so that happened. But folks have been claiming that that's exactly the same thing as what happened with Cambridge Analytica, which it's not. It's not. PolitiFact rates that claim as half true for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, again, the Obama campaign had people opt in. So users knew that they were handing over their data, but the friends of those users did not. To be clear about that, in the Cambridge Analytica case, users didn't even know their data would be used by a political campaign. They just, all they knew is they were taking a personality quiz. And then the Obama campaign also used the data to have supporters contact their most persuadable friends, whereas Cambridge Analytica, as we now know, was targeting users' friends and lookalikes directly with digital ads. But in any case, the point is that Facebook until 2015 allowed, and virtually, Ed, to your point, any developer who wanted it to have tons of information. So it's a little complicated, but I did want to provide that clarification because Hiawatha was going top speed and I couldn't correct him then in the moment.
I'm glad you did it because I've seen a lot of people compare the two situations. I've actually used the APIs before and after the change, and they did specifically ban it because they decided letting you get your friends' data without permission of the friends was a bad idea. So they stopped that a few years ago. I remember when the change happened, we were all like, oh, it was so useful. But we realized that it was unethical and we're glad that it went away.
Okay. So one positive change there. All right, so let's move on to another story from this week. This one has to do with former WBUR and NPR host Tom Ashbrook. Just as a recap for folks who may have missed this, he was fired by Boston University, which holds our broadcast license here at WBUR. He was fired in February after university investigators found that he had created an abusive work environment. They absolved him of any responsibility in a separate investigation about alleged sexual harassment. The university had put him on leave in December after 11 current and former employees filed complaints against him. And this week, Tom Ashbrook penned an op-ed in the Boston Globe asking for redemption from Boston. He said, "Is there room for redemption and rebirth in our time of Google Trails and hashtag headlines?" John, dying to know what you think about this.
Well, for the life of me, I don't understand why the Boston Globe would run such a half-baked, tin-eared, self-serving semi-apology. It doesn't make sense to me. And I may be old-fashioned, but I think the thing that normally would be done here is you go into the desert and you wander around for a decent interval, and then you come back and you sort of try to earn the trust back. And,
of the people who you actually wronged.
Of the people you wronged, and also the people you deprived of talented people who might have contributed to WBUR in this case particularly. And I just think that this whole attitude of, what I have to say is too important for me to be sidelined more than 3 months, I just find that insulting, frankly.
Okay, Ed.
So I thought it was amusing that they published it. And I told Ellen Clegg, the director of the 12-page editor, that I thought it was interesting she ran it. I believe that people do wrong. It's not just by the people he worked with. Obviously, he can make restitution to them privately and not involve the Boston Globe. That's not why the piece ran. The piece ran because he felt like that he'd wronged the community in terms of our values, how we want to see our media operate. And I think he doesn't know what to do in the desert, I think, is the issue. So one thing I suggested on Twitter was to say that Why doesn't he just say, and now I'm going to volunteer at PRX's podcast garage and help new voices get into the world of radio? I think that if he sort of ended with, and this is the community service project I'm going to be doing, try to use my skills to help others succeed, I would have said, well, okay. So I think it's an interesting debate. Like, what do people who are fallen Bostonians, what do they do to get back on their good graces? How can they earn that back? And I was disappointed in the fact that he didn't sort of have some sort of like plan of how he's going to become a good citizen again. So I wasn't thrilled about the language he used, but I thought, well, sure, let's just come up with ideas and maybe we can help him in the desert figure out what to do.
Okay, so I'm going to take a deep breath here because, man, I have a lot to say. In the interest, first of all, full disclosure, I worked for Tom for 5.5 years. My first job in journalism was as a producer at On Point. And I loved it. Tom treated me great. He's one of my mentors. And I don't know if he's listening to this right now, but it's exactly because of that reason that I found his pseudo-apology in The Globe to be disgraceful. Because I know that he has the capacity to treat people well. I learned a huge amount from him. He was great to me. And it just pains me every single day to think, what if he had treated all those other producers with the same encouragement and, yes, high standards, but friendship and mentorship that he treated me? I mean, John, to the point you were saying earlier, he has the capacity to do it. I don't know why he didn't do it for everyone, and I cannot imagine the journalistic careers that got snuffed out because he didn't. So I don't know if Tom's listening to this. This is really hard because, again, he's a mentor of mine. But the first thing that we teach kindergartners to do when they do something wrong is you hold hat in hand and you go to the person that you wronged and you say, I am sorry for what I did to you. How can I fix it? Boston out there is not the entity or the people that he wronged. He doesn't need to. I'm sorry, Ed. I disagree with you. I don't think he thinks he's wounded Boston and has to do right by the city. Tom is trying to rehabilitate his own self-image now, and he's just chosen the wrong way to do it.
When he asked Boston, can we talk, the overwhelming response in the comments, both to his op-ed and to Yvonne Abraham's column the following day, was, no, we can't talk. There's nothing to talk about here until you come to your senses and realize that you weren't unjustifiably fired. And I think that that's the part that really galls people, is that, and I don't know, Tom, I didn't have any connection to him, or I didn't have any dealings with him. But the whole idea that you have to be sort of abusive to have a high-quality show, I think is just dismissible out of hand. And I think that is the dodge that he has been using since the beginning of this. And I just think that's wrong. There are many, many examples of people who have high-quality standards, who produce high-quality programming, who are not abusive to other people.
Ed, do you have another thought here?
Well, I think that I do think Boston was wrong. I mean, I heard about that. I said, wait a second, this is Boston. These are not our virtues. Why? How did this happen here? So I felt like that shouldn't have happened here, that this is not how we treat people here. And so I did feel a little bit of a sting, even though I've never met him and I didn't really listen to his show very much. So I do feel that there is some restitution to the city, that it pales in comparison to individual people, of course. But of course, it's only been 3 months. It's not like he's going to be a new person in 3 months. So I just think that, I wouldn't have written it that way, and I wouldn't have acted like, oh, well, I'll have high ratings. I mean, one more thing I'll say. We've all known people over the years who were the star performer in some organization who got away with things because they were the rainmaker, the superstar. It doesn't matter whether you worked in finance, something else. There are people who bend the rules because they know they're making the organization happen. So when I heard about him, I'm like, I know people like that who got away with things because they were the star. And I hope that others in Boston learn that being a star is not an excuse to do this in whatever organization you work in.
So one more thing. With all due respect to our colleagues at The Globe, I don't know why they've given Tom 3 separate chances to have his say in the newspaper. Shirley Leung wrote about him in the first days after he got fired. Joan Vinnocchi did. And now he's got an op-ed in The Globe. I mean, with all due respect, The Globe may want to actually have a public reckoning about the problems that it has internally with harassment as well. I have yet to see that coming. So it just seems to me to be slightly bizarre to give a man who went through two investigations and was found wanting by them a chance to redeem himself 3 times when they're not even doing due diligence about things happening in their own newsroom. Am I No, off base on that, John?
Profound lack of self-awareness on the part of the people at the Globe.
I thought it was weird they had so much content. Like, they had a story about a comment on the op-ed. I said, we're doing a story about the comment on the op-ed. I thought it was, like, I thought the amount of coverage was a surprise.
Well, I think there's also sort of like it got people's blood going. So there was a lot of clicking going on. But I'm out of time here. I ranted and ran out of time for our hubbub. So if you guys will just forgive me, there's one last thing I want to say about this.
Absolutely.
Tom Ashbrook aside, I just want everybody listening to know that there are a couple of hundred incredibly decent and mission-driven people who work at this station. And you hear a handful of us on the air, but you don't even know the names of the people off air who are doing this work every day and all day long. And these have been rough times for us. And I just want to tell all of you, my colleagues here at WBUR, that we are going to come out of this stronger. We are going to come out of this better. And I am incredibly proud and incredibly privileged to work with all of you, because you treat each other with profound respect and you treat our listeners with profound respect. And I wouldn't want to work anywhere else. So thank you to you all. And I shall step off of my soapbox now and say
Amen.
Thank you to John Carroll, professor of journalism at Boston University and WBUR's senior news analyst, and to Ed Lyons, Massachusetts political writer and Republican activist. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is WBUR's Radio Boston.